All right, everyone. Well, thanks very much for joining us today. I'm very pleased to say I have via Skype Max Tuck. Max is a health educator who has graduated from the famous Hippocrates Health Institute in West Palm Beach, Florida, and brings their time-proven approach for optimal health and vitality to the UK. Max, who in 1990 cured herself of chronic fatigue and Epstein-Barr virus through a radical change in her diet and lifestyle, embraced the living food lifestyle since 1998, previously enjoying a high percentage raw food diet since 1990. Since her recovery, which was a surprise to the medical profession, she has run marathons, competed in triathlons, mountain bike races, and other demanding endurance events. Climb mountains, and is even a black belt in karate, so better watch out. She's a popular speaker at health seminars and regularly presents lectures and practical demonstrations. So Max, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure.
Sure. So I thought I'd kick off with perhaps you could explain to everyone your journey to the raw food lifestyle. I mean, were you as a child, sort of growing up on the usual meat and two veg diet, and so what sort of changed that? What happened that made you change?
Well, I think I've always been interested in food from quite an early age because, as a child, as a very young child, I decided to go on hunger strike for 11 months and hardly ate anything. But my food choices back then, as a little kid, were a little bit bizarre. Now, after that, I rapidly realised that I hated cooked vegetables, and so I would only eat veg if my mum gave them to me raw. So that was maybe I realised even back then at age 5, 6, 7 that I perhaps was actually a raw fooder, but didn't actually know about it back then so much. But
yeah.
I never liked soggy veg, and I think it's the same for all of us, isn't it? Do you remember if you ever went round to Granny's house for Sunday lunch, and she'd stick the cabbage on to boil at about 6:30 in the morning when you were going to sit down for lunch at midday or 1 o'clock, and there'd be nothing left apart from kind of anemic mush.
That's right, yeah. I think I'll put
into that. I think my first kind of breakthrough, I suppose, is how food can affect us came at about age 15 when I'd been a severe eczema sufferer for about, 14 out of my first 15 years on the planet. And at age 15, I decided that I really was quite sick of having horrible scabs covering most of my body, and I was really fed up with the taunts. And at age 15, boys tend to come onto the scene as well, don't they? And so I wanted to have decent skin like some of the girls I was at school with. So I decided that maybe it was food-related, even though my doctor didn't believe in allergies. And so decided, for whatever reason, to completely eliminate dairy products from my diet at age 15. And funnily enough, within 8 weeks, my skin was completely clear, having had 14 years on steroids. So that actually opened my eyes to the possibilities of how food can affect us, both positively and negatively. I suppose I then just kind of trundled along with the standard British diet, albeit without dairy products, from about age 15 all through my student years in London, and then round about age 27, that's when I got my sort of thunderous wake-up call, which was the sort of double whammy of PUR, Epstein-Barr virus, and chronic fatigue, both at the same time. I kind of crashed health-wise at age 27. That was back in 1990, as you mentioned. Something fairly radical had to happen because I went to the doctor, they did a number of blood tests, and they said, yes, you haven't actually got an immune system. And my weight plummeted, I had severe muscle wastage. And for somebody that had previously been fairly fit and healthy, it had all just kind of disappeared into a big pile of mush. So I decided that since the medical profession gave me really no option apart from to give up work and to accept the fact that I was never going to get over it, I thought, right, okay, they can't help me. I know that viruses can't be fixed by medication. So since I didn't have an immune system, I decided that I'd better go and try and find out how to build one. So that's when it all started. And I think the major thing back in 1990, of course, there was no internet, so I couldn't really jump on Google and see what was going on and how I could fix myself. So I just had to get information wherever I could. And I remember very vividly one day just nipping around the supermarket, or rather not nipping around the supermarket because I couldn't nip, I could only just crawl supported by my shopping trolley. And I looked at a magazine that was called Health and Fitness. And I thought, yeah, there are two things I used to have that just don't seem to be evident anymore. So at that stage, I thought, right, okay, buy the magazine, see what it says. And of course, back then, it was we were still being told, weren't we, that we should be eating five servings of fruit and veg a day. Now, of course, most of us know now that five is woefully inadequate. But having said that, I thought, right, okay, if that's what we need to be healthy, then clearly I'm not healthy, I need to do significantly more than that. So decided to have 10 fruit and 10 veg every single day. And of course, because of my childhood instincts of hating cooked veg, I was eating it all raw. So when you're eating large quantities, 10 servings of each fruit and veg per day, there's really not an awful lot of room for anything else. So my consumption of meat and all the other sort of cooked carbohydrate stuff that I've been eating in the past, that I thought was the way we should be eating in the Western world, that kind of just dropped away almost immediately. And I ended up having really, I suppose, a high percentage raw diet, but high fruit, which I don't do anymore, really from sort of mid-1990 onwards. Now, the other thing I also did was because I didn't have any muscles, and I used to be very strong and fit and able to throw things around quite easily, I decided that poor old wasted body needed some muscle back, so I decided to start going to the gym and to running. And to start with, it was all rather disappointing. I couldn't really lift any weights, and I could only run to about a bat and its lamp post before thinking I might collapse. But I stuck with it because I've got one of these sort of rather tenacious characters. I don't give up on anything. So that was my mission. My mission was to rebuild my body. And within 6 months, I decided I'd go back to the doctor and say, well, you really broke me off. Can you check me out? Because I actually feel okay now. And they did check me out. They took some more blood. And everything was back to normal.
Wow.
There was no sign of the virus. So he said, really, that's not supposed to happen. So I then said, well, hey-ho, do you want to know how I did it? And he was a bit disinterested, which was really quite sad, because 5 years later he had a heart attack.
Yeah, isn't it true, like, doctors, they're really the last person you should ask about nutrition? I read they sort of don't really, in their training, don't really have any coaching on, you know, diet and nutrition. Their job is just to cure you of an illness.
That's right. They're very, very good at prescribing. They're excellent at working out symptoms and working out what needs to be done with prescription medication. That is absolutely what they're trained to do. But I've got some friends who are doctors, and I decided that I would ask them, because I'd heard this information quite a long time ago, back in the early 90s, that they're not trained in nutrition. So I thought, well, I know some people that have recently graduated from medical school, so I'll ask them what their nutritional training was. And it's still not much better, unfortunately. They have an optional 4-hour lecture on nutrition, and it's optional.
What, in like 7 years of medical training?
That was 5 years.
Five years.
Four hours optional in 5 years. It shows you where the bias is, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah. Oh, well. And can I just check, you never ate meat at all during at any time in your life, or did you come off that when you were finished cooked vegetable?
I did eat meat. I was brought up as a meat eater because my parents thought that that's what we should be doing. Then I think back in the 70s and the late 60s, vegetarianism was seen as it's only things that freaks and hippies do.
Yeah.
My parents were under the belief that everybody needed meat, and even if I didn't want to eat what was on my plate, Mum would always say, eat your meat. So I was brought up in that mindset that everybody needs meat, otherwise we can't grow or we can't develop and we can't remain strong. I've since very definitely changed my views on that aspect, and I think there's hardly anybody that has a physiological need for meat. But no, I was brought up as a meat eater, but I dropped it from my diet in the early 90s.
Right, right. I suppose that leads into the inevitable protein question. You know, like, I mean, I haven't eaten meat for 15 years now. And, yeah, it's always the question, where do you get your protein from? Where do you get your protein from?
Yeah, and that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah, and I get rather sick of hearing the question, so...
Yeah, you and me both, I think. It is an important issue, isn't it? Because it's the first thing that anybody that has any inkling about nutrition, it's always going to be, what about protein? Because we're told it's the most important thing, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right.
And my reply to that is that, yes, protein is important, and even its name comes from the word of prime importance. It comes from the Greek word proteos, which means of prime importance. And that is actually true, but true protein deficiency is incredibly rare. Have you ever heard of a condition called kwashiorkor?
No, I haven't.
It is a medical condition, and it's true protein deficiency, and it's confined to famine-ridden parts of Africa. We just don't see it anywhere in the Western world. And I picked up on a fairly interesting, well, what I think is a fairly interesting statistic on protein, and that is, of the 310 million people that live in the United States, probably 310 million, isn't it, the population?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Probably 300 million of them are suffering from diseases associated with excess protein, and probably only 3 have not enough protein. Three out of 310 million. So we are seeing now diseases of protein excess, such as cancer, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and all of the conditions that associate with just having too much protein, also arthritis, obesity, various problems that we're now seeing. But interestingly, according to some major studies that have actually been done recently, that only happens if you're getting your protein from animal sources. If you're eating plant-based protein, it appears that you can eat pretty much as much as you want without it causing the increased risk of these degenerative diseases that we're starting to see so many of in the Western world. So it's not the protein itself, it's where that protein comes from. Because when we base our protein requirements on animal bodies, we don't just get protein, do we? We get fat, we get cholesterol, we get all of the other things that are associated with an increase in the risk of degenerative diseases. And when we eat our protein from plants, and it was a myth, isn't there, that you can't get a full spectrum of proteins from plants. You need certain essential amino acids, which of course we know. But there is there's still this myth around that seems to be perpetuated still in nutrition, that you can only get a good spectrum of protein and amino acids from animal sources. But there are many proteins available to us vegans, and particularly us living foods vegans, from plants, that contain a full spectrum of amino acids, particularly one of the essential ones. So it is easy to be protein deficient if you're what I describe a junk vegan. Now, there are plenty of junk vegans around. I know a number of them who are vegan for ethical reasons rather than health reasons. And to me, there's nothing wrong with that. Just because you're not depriving the body of nutrients just from a political or ethical standpoint, I think we all, yes, we need to take ethics into consideration, but we don't want to be destroying our health just because of our personal beliefs. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
So I think from a protein perspective, certainly we know that we can get all the proteins we need from a good intake of plant foods every day. But also, just I think the quantities of protein that we actually need have been vastly overestimated. And we're being told now that the total quantity of protein that a human actually needs, unless they're in very, very specific conditions, will fit into the palm of your hand. Now, that's amazing, isn't it? When we see, particularly on the other side of the Atlantic, where I've spent quite a lot of time, in standard restaurants, you can get served up with a 32-ounce steak. Mm. Now, for heaven's sake, that would actually keep a family of four going for a week.
Yeah.
it's amazing the kind of excesses that seem to be now considered to be relatively normal, or even excellent protein recyclers, we can actually use an awful lot of the protein that's broken down in our bodies on a daily basis. We can recycle that, and we're very, very good at it. And I think it's just a trait of humans that we have this ability to recycle proteins that have been used up and broken down and make them into something else. So our daily intake really doesn't have to be that high. There are a couple of exceptions, and that would be people that are doing seriously huge amounts of endurance activity and utilising breaking down their muscle tissue an awful lot. And the other thing is medical conditions. Certain medical conditions have a very high protein requirement. And the one that stands out to me is the third degree burns victim. They are going to need a massive excess of protein in comparison with what our daily requirements would be calculated at, just because of the losses that they're experiencing. But unless you've got third degree burns, or unless you are an endurance athlete who's doing ridiculous amounts of training every day, our protein requirements really will just get into the palm of our hand.
Yeah. So would you, those sort of people, yeah, you get into health food shots and then those like massive kind of jars of protein supplements, which seem
yes.
aimed at the, you know, the kind of running, as you say, endurance market. Are those are those products that you would, that you take or you recommend, or are they
absolutely not? No. I do. There are certain protein powders that I recommend that certain people might want to incorporate into a smoothie, but they would be the vegan protein powders, such as those based on hemp protein or sprouted brown rice protein. That's a popular one, and that has been proven to have a number of health benefits. But for the average person, I really don't feel that protein supplementation is particularly necessary, unless you have been tested to metabolically need it. But that's when we start getting into blood testing and various other more sort of advanced medical diagnostics. And most people aren't actually having that done. So, no, for the average person, even the average person that wants to eat raw food, that wants to remain healthy, it has been stated by a number of experts in the field that if you're eating, you're getting enough protein. As I say, there are a few exceptions. Some people that particularly are wanting to build up muscle, that are doing a lot of weight training, for example, would benefit from some of the sprouted brown rice protein powders that are available, maybe hemp protein as well. But for the average person, if you're not trying to build large quantities of extra muscle, then it's probably very unnecessary. But I think whenever there's a market for something, people are going to jump on the bandwagon, aren't they, and it's going to be pushed. And I think that's what's happened. We all know protein is important. We all know that muscles are fundamentally made of protein. So there seems to be this kind of commitment almost from manufacturing companies that they have to push protein, because a little bit of knowledge, I think, can be a dangerous thing. The only way we build large amounts of muscle is to actually train it. We have to do the physical work, but we cannot just build large amounts of muscle just by drinking protein shakes. It's not going to happen. We've got to work those muscles to build them. And yes, I do see a lot of protein shake guzzlers, particularly those based on whey protein, which of course is a dairy product, so something that is absolutely not close to my heart. And dairy protein has been shown in many studies to actually be highly detrimental in the long term, so it's really not something I recommend to anybody.
Yes, yeah. Just something you said a bit earlier, you talked about you knew people who are vegan junkies.
Yes.
Could you kind of talk about that? What do you mean by that? And what are they eating that they're vegan, but what are they doing wrong?
Well, a classic example is somebody that I used to work with who was absolutely lovely, very committed to animal welfare, and as a result of that didn't want to use anything that had caused suffering to animals, and absolutely didn't want to eat animals or any animal derivatives, and she was very, very, very careful. However, the interesting thing about her was that she smoked continuously, so of course that's been tested on animals, but because she was addicted, that didn't seem to make any difference. So that was a slight anomaly, but she would eat lots of soy-based meat substitutes, so for example, a lot of soya cheese and textured vegetable protein that's derived from genetically modified soy sources and that sort of thing. She didn't eat fruit, she didn't eat fresh vegetables. It was all just potatoes and meat substitutes. And goodness me, was she ever unhealthy.
All right. So like the corn products sort of thing, those like, it's things that like look like bacon and taste like it, but made from soy products. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. We're finding now that a lot of research is indicating as well that soya is very definitely not a health food, and I know it has been touted as a health food, and it's still sold in many health stores. But we know now that there are disadvantages to getting your protein from soy products, quite simply because they do create difficulties with metabolism in many people.
Oh.
And evidently, they're also responsible for feminization of men. So we really don't want our guys becoming more feminine, I wouldn't have thought. So I think certainly it's absolutely something that men should be steering away from.
All right. So in terms of like a milk substitute, like if you're going to have cereal or something, rather than have a soy milk, what would you recommend, like a nut milk or a rice milk?
I'd say if you're going to do that, then definitely make your own rice milks or nut milks. And they're very, very easy to make, and they taste so much better than the ones that you can buy in packets. Now, if you've not actually moved on to that stage, or if you don't possess a high-power blender that's necessary to make your own nut milks, then just avoid the soy-based milks. Go for rice milk or almond milk instead. Even if you are buying it in a packet, it's going to be better than the packeted soy milks, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so, talking about nuts, I'm going to probably move on to the next fat issue. So I've just been reading recently about somebody who's written a book about sort of fruit and vegetable eating, and they said a lot of vegans don't realise their fat intake can be almost as high, if not higher, than someone still on meat, because they're eating a lot of high fat, seeds and nuts, and certain products like avocados, for example, high in fat. So their fat intake is way above what it should be. So I mean, obviously nuts and seeds are a big part of a vegan diet. So how can we kind of deal with that problem?
I think nuts and seeds, they have had some bad press, haven't they? And if we're trying to bulk up our calorie intake by having a lot of nutritionally dense foods, then of course the nuts and seeds are the most nutritionally dense on the vegan diet, whether that's a raw vegan diet or a cooked vegan diet. Now, it's absolutely true that we don't want to be exceeding about 20% of our calories from fat. But we also do need to think about the protein issue, as we've already discussed. So the thing about nuts and seeds is that they are a good source of protein, but they're also, as you quite rightly say, quite high in fat. So we can minimise that. We can have smaller quantities on a daily basis, or we can just have them on alternate days. So for example, at the Hopkins Institute, with regard to avocados, which you mentioned, what they do there is they have an avocado day. So they don't give you heavy, dense fat-protein combinations on a daily basis. They alternate it. So Mondays and Thursdays at the Cockatoos are avocado day. So you have them twice a week, and you're limited to one small one or half of a larger one when you have it, so as to minimise the fat intake. Because, yes, we don't want to be having vast amounts of fat. Now, let's get one thing clear, though. There's a big difference between the fat that you would get from cooked animal flesh. And remember that meat is 30% fat before you even start, and some meat is even higher than that. So if you're getting cooked, cholesterol-laden, artery-clogging, fully saturated animal fat, that is rather different from the fat that you'll get from, for example, fresh raw olives, avocados, which are high in monounsaturated fats, or soaked almonds, for example. Now, I stress the word soaked there because there are a lot of living fooders that I know, raw food people, who are eating large amounts of unsoaked nuts and seeds, and they're wondering why they haven't got any energy. Now, nuts and seeds are the things that take the longest for us to digest. They take about 4 hours. And I think, particularly after we get to a certain age, we need a bit of help with our digestion, don't we? Yeah. So we're not able to kind of tolerate everything we used to just shovel in the past and not even think about. I'm a great believer in keeping the proteins and the high-density foods away from the carbohydrate-based foods. In other words, good food combining. And we can also improve the digestibility of nuts and seeds by soaking them overnight. Now, the reason that works is because what we're doing by soaking is we're removing the enzyme inhibitors. So it actually allows that nut or seed to think it's starting to develop. And the enzyme inhibitors are removed, and the nutritional value of that food by the sort of sprouting process increases. So in other words, we are actually enabling ourselves to make better use of that food, and we're enabling ourselves to not spend so much digestive energy on it. Mm-hmm. So all in all, I'm a big fan of if you're eating nuts and seeds, and I personally don't have them on a daily basis, I have them maybe every 2 or 3 days, I will always soak them overnight first. And firstly, I think it improves the flavour, and secondly, it makes them much, much easier to digest and utilise. It's been estimated, I think, that everybody, or pretty much everybody over the age of 40 in the Western world has some kind of digestive issue. And up to 60% of us over here, I think, and maybe even more, have some kind of digestive problem, no matter what our age. And there's a lot we can do, particularly if shifting more towards the living foods and raw diets, just by soaking nuts and seeds when we're having them. It will make a big difference to how well we're able to utilise them. And anybody that comes to me saying, well, I'm doing this raw food thing, I'm feeling tired, I'll always look at exactly what they're eating on a daily basis, and we'll talk about breakfast, lunch and dinner. And then we'll go into how their digestion is affected by that and how we can improve things. And it usually comes down to the fact that they're A, doing poor food combining, B, not soaking nuts and seeds before use, or C, just eating too much of something at the wrong time of day. And it's usually quite easy to rectify that kind of situation just by tweaking the time of day and that we're eating things, and also the way in which we're eating them, such as soaked versus unsoaked. But you're quite right, there's a lot of controversy, I think, with regard to raw and living food. And there are some people in the living foods movement that are saying you must never, ever, ever have any more than 10% of your diet as fat. And you must be low fat, low fat, low fat, to the exclusion of sort of everything, really. Now, we do need, it's important to remember that we do actually need fat. It is an important component of our diet. And I've done a CD that's all about this. But we do need fat because we need fat to manufacture hormones, for example, which are pretty important things. We need fat for all sorts of reasons. We need fat for good skin quality, so that it acts as a decent barrier against infection. Our skin, of course, is our first line of defence. So if we focus on very little or even no fat raw food diets, I personally believe that we can actually run into trouble. I think it's this sort of excess versus nothing, isn't it? A little of something is good. A lot of it can be detrimental, but none of it can also be detrimental. So it's getting the balance right. And I think if we're aiming for about 20% of our calories coming from fat on a raw food diet, then I think we've probably got it about right.
And that would be fat, the kind of monounsaturated. We've got to avoid the saturated fat, haven't we? That's the sort of the nasty one, isn't it?
Well, saturated fats had some bad press. Saturated fat, we tend to think about it coming from animals, which of course it does. But there's the coconut oil, for example, which in small quantities can have benefits to health. And if we have, for example, an underactive thyroid, coconut oil is quite good at feeding the thyroid. So a teaspoon of that per day is going to be beneficial. What we want to avoid is being one of those raw fooders that I call, I know some junk raw fooders, for example. Some of my friends are junk raw fooders, and they live on raw cakes and raw chocolate and high fat raw food snacks. And yes, they're fun, but they are recreational foods. That's not what we should be building our lives around and having on a daily basis. It's kind of the weekend treat if we want to. But there are some of those things very high fat and high sugar, and that's not the way to build our bodies for a healthier future. They're recreational treat foods. So yes, a lot of sweets and cakes and these sort of things that we have that taste amazing contain high quantities of coconut oil and high quantities of liquid sugars. So they're really not something that we want to be incorporating on a daily basis. An excess of anything can be detrimental. I think it's Doug Graham, isn't it, that says everything that's good for you is good for you in moderation. Everything that's harmful is harmful regardless of dose. So I think that's an important point to bear in mind, whether we totally agree with everything else that Deborah Ann is recommending or not, and some people do and some people don't. I think that's a very, very useful statement to follow, and that everything that's good for us, we don't want to be overdoing it. More is not necessarily better.
No. And I suppose the third element of food is carbohydrates. And I've read that's going to be your biggest component of any diet. Would you agree with that?
I think the biggest component of our diet should be greens. Greens have been shown to contain everything beneficial and nothing detrimental or controversial. I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all with this. And I think once we start to get into some of the things that some of the health centres in the States are doing, such as metabolic typing, glucose tolerance testing, those sort of things, I think it becomes very evident that not everybody has exactly the same type of metabolism. And I think certainly at the Tree of Life in Arizona, run by Gabriel Cousins, he's doing metabolic typing of people, and he's finding that there are two main types of metabolic status that dominate in humans, and he's tested over 30,000 people, and he's finding that some people need more protein than others, and some people need fewer carbohydrates than others. So I think for somebody to say, we need 10% of this, 50% of this, 30% of that, or whatever it happens to be, I think it's generalising, and I don't think it's necessarily the right thing to be telling everybody, because we are all different. Yes, okay, we are fundamentally the same, and as much as we're Homo sapiens and we've got, you know, two eyes, two arms, two legs, and walk upright, and we've got a certain hip structure, and we've got, 98% of our genes are the same as the chimpanzee or something. But that doesn't mean that there are not individual differences that are put forward by our own personal genetic code. So genetics, I think, does play a part in this. I don't believe that genetics holds the key to everything, in fact, far from it. But I think for somebody to say as a blanket statement, we must focus on carbohydrates, I think that could be detrimental to protein dominant types, which have actually been found to be true that there are people that are faster protein burners, if we want to sort of straightforward way to put it. So for those people, focusing on getting nearly all of their calories from carbohydrates potentially could be disastrous metabolically for them. So I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all, and this is why I feel it's very important for people to tailor their diet to the individual, because, for example, myself and my boyfriend are both living food eaters. We don't eat cooked food at all. And we've been doing this he's been doing it for a decade, I've been doing it for longer. And if I ate his diet, I wouldn't do as well as if I ate the diet that I'm eating. He would not survive on the diet that I eat. He needs more protein than I do. So, yes, we're both English, we're both blonde. You'd look at us and you'd think we're related. But that doesn't mean that our metabolisms run in the same way. So what works for me doesn't work for him. And we've worked that out over the years that we've known each other. So it's I think we do need to consider the individualization of the diet, whether that's a totally raw food diet, whether it's an 80-20, or even what percentage you're using. I think we're all individuals, and we need to be treated as such.
Yeah. And turning to your sort of particular your interest in marathons and triathlons and endurance stuff, someone listening to this who's into that sort of thing as well, how have they got to sort of change their diet in order to be able to do those sort of events? I mean, do you have a ritual pre a race that that you go through that sort of gets you high in one particular nutritional product before you start a race? How does it work for you?
What I do personally is rather different from what the standard, I suppose, athlete that might be running, I don't know, the Olympic 10K or something, because what upsets me quite a lot at the moment is that all of these sports energy drinks are being pushed for athletes. And if you look at the ingredients in those things, I mean, the last race I did was the Great South last year, which is a 10-miler, the UK, or I think Europe's biggest 10-mile road race. And we get a goodie bag at the end, and I was absolutely horrified as to what was in my goodie bag. There was this high-energy sports drink, and there were these liquid gels, and I just chucked it all in the bin, or the other option would have been to give it to somebody that I didn't like. What I do prior to a race is, firstly, even when I wasn't eating a 100% raw food diet, I think I was the only person that I can think of that ran a marathon on an empty stomach. I just cannot eat before I do a big race. So what I do is I have a massive green juice. Now, in my green juice, I have a base of celery and cucumber. Now, the celery is particularly good because it's got a lot of electrolytes in it. It's got salts and it's got beneficial things for people that are sweating a lot. So celery is fantastic as something that's going to provide sufficient electrolytes to get you through the sweat that you will lose in a big race. Cucumber is incredibly hydrating. It's better hydrating than water is. So the cucumber is my sort of hydrating sports drink. And then to that, I will always add sunflower greens and pea shoots. Now, they're my proteins, and also carbohydrate, of course. But they're very, very easy to digest because they're sprouted, they're full of enzymes. Then I just run all that through the juicer. I sometimes add a little bit of ginger, or if I want to annoy people, I'll add a bit of garlic and then breathe on them. No, seriously, I don't do that before a race. I'm not that nasty. Right. I will have that, and I'll have quite a large amount of that, but not within 1 hour of racing, because I need to feel that everything has been absorbed. Now, green juice, typically like that, will take about 30 to 60 minutes to be fully absorbed. So I like to have that at least an hour before I do a big race. I will point out at this stage that I don't race nearly as much as I used to. But I do still do endurance stuff, such as my karate, which I take my karate training quite seriously. So if I'm going to a big international course, for example, such as the one that I was at last weekend, then I would just take a flask of green juice with me, and that sees me through the 3 hours of training. And I do have some athlete clients that come to me and say, "Might have a race coming up, how can you help me prepare nutritionally?" And I think it's important to say that from the outset, we need to start working on nutrition at least 6 weeks before a major race rather than the night before. But absolutely, I would always say to anybody, if you want to get to a race well hydrated, with good electrolyte balance, then you really can't go wrong with a big green juice, because it's just absolutely everything in it that you need. And forget those sports energy drinks, this will do you an awful lot more good. The other thing is, it's alkalizing. And that's really important, because when we're doing heavy amounts of intense exercise, we create an acidic state in the body, and we also generate rather large quantities of free radicals, which will need lots of antioxidants to mop up. So when we're doing something like major endurance, we definitely do need to have all of those nutrients, not only to fuel the performance, but we need something that is going to speed our recovery. And that's the difference, isn't it, between somebody that's able to do serious amounts of training and somebody that may stumble at the first or second hurdle, and that is the recovery rate. Because if you can't recover properly from a major event, you're not then going to be able to get the training in to stand you in good stead for the next one. So we not only need to fuel ourselves for the event itself, we need to fuel ourselves for recovery afterwards. And I think that's where the living foods diet, particularly when we're doing a lot of juicing, the dark green juices, it really comes into its own. And I've seen athletes, just by incorporating the green juice daily, smash their personal best in every discipline. So it is amazing just by what you can achieve just by adding one thing.
Mm.
And when you start adding lots of other good things as well, you really can make a big difference to the performance that you can manage on a big day.
Yeah. And so what sort of quantity of green juice would you take before, say you were doing, I don't know, half a marathon, so 13 miles,
yes.
What quantity would you, have a green juice every day, it's like one cucumber and a couple of sticks of celery. So if you're coming up to a big race, so how do you increase that amount or frequency of it? What would your regime be?
I would up the quantity. So what I would do is, on the day of the race, I would have two glasses of green juice, which would probably equate to 1.5 cucumbers, 4 or 5 sticks of celery, a big handful of sunflower greens, a big handful of pea greens, and possibly also I would put in some liquid blue green algae into that as well, just for a little bit of an extra protein boost. Mm. So yes, that would be my pre-race drink. And it's got me around a number of races.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, when I was seriously marathoning, I wish I'd known about green juice at that stage. But back in 1992, 1994, I didn't actually have a juicer. I didn't buy one until 95, 96, I think. So it was an awful lot easier once I got juicing, because you can just plan in so many more nutrients when you're juicing than you could ever manage just by trying to eat the stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And wheatgrass, does that figure in the diet as well?
I love wheatgrass. Oh, yeah. I really do. And everybody when I start mentioning wheatgrass, we're going to have a shot of wheatgrass today, people start turning their nose up and saying, oh, do we have to? My boyfriend doesn't like wheatgrass very much. They don't have a particularly good relationship. But I personally love wheatgrass, and I grow all of my own sprouts. And one of the things I do as well is I teach sprouting classes, so I can help other people to grow their own and not have to buy it in. So I do grow all of my own stuff, but wheatgrass is always on the sprouting rack, and I grow my own pea shoots, my own sunflower greens, and you can buy all these things in. It's absolutely fine to just, when you're first starting, to just buy all these things in. There's nothing wrong with that. And you can buy a tray of wheatgrass. If you can't get through the whole lot, then you can cut it and juice it, and either keep it in the fridge cut, or what you can do is you can juice the whole lot, put it into little ice cube trays, and then just defrost it as and when you need it. You'll lose 30% of the enzymes, but the rest of the nutritional value will be intact. Wheatgrass is excellent because, of course, if we think about the grass eaters, the herbivores, they're some of the biggest, strongest, most muscular animals on the planet, aren't they?
That's right.
And they build those huge, powerful bodies that are amazingly strong and healthy just by eating grass. Now, it could be argued, of course, humans are not natural grass eaters. No, we're not. Of course we're not. Otherwise, we would have four stomachs and walk on four legs, wouldn't we? But we don't have four stomachs, and last time I looked, we weren't walking on four legs. And we can't digest the cellulose that's in grass. If we chewed up grass, we could chew it all day, but we wouldn't get as much out of it as a herbivore would. And the first thing that you see when you look out at your garden, for example, you don't think, oh, food. No, we don't. But with wheatgrass, it's wonderful stuff because it contains a full spectrum of essential amino acids. It contains all of the protein that we need, and it's very, very high in chlorophyll, which is important for detoxification, building the blood, and lots of other... In fact, even before antibiotics, I don't know if you're aware, but back in the 1940s, we used to use chlorophyll for everything because antibiotics hadn't been discovered or invented or whatever you like to think about them. Chlorophyll was used very extensively in medicine in the 1930s and 1940s, and it only fell out of favour because it couldn't be stored, and it had to be used as soon as it was made. So it's the same with wheat grass, really. It has amazing properties, and I think anybody wanting to really improve their health at a cellular level could do a lot worse than to drink a shot of wheat grass juice every day. And it's certainly very much a part of my regime, and it's something that I do recommend for anybody that's serious about health improvement.
Yeah, I do grow my own myself. Well, I seem to have a problem with it. It sort of grows to a certain height and then it just starts keeling over. And I was just wondering, am I not wetting it enough, or what do you think might be the problem?
Yes, it sounds as though you've either grown it too much or it's not been having enough water. Now, what I do with mine is I soak it. I give it a really good soaking until all the water drips out of the tray. And I do that once a day. And if it's hot, it doesn't like being in direct. I grow mine on the back outside the front door, which is sheltered, and it likes about 70% shade. So you don't want to be growing it in direct sun, because otherwise it will tend to pop over and wilt a bit. So if you're doing that, if you can't grow it anywhere, if you haven't got the facility to grow it anywhere else but in direct sun, then what I would do is give a good soaking once a day, and then in the evening just mist it with one of those water sprayers, because I think that would help. The other thing is that I think there's a bit of a mistake that some people make with wheat grass, and that is that they grow it too high. We don't go by how tall it is when it's ready to harvest. What we go by is the actual shoot itself. When it starts growing a second shoot, that's when it's ready for harvesting. What we don't want to do is wait until it gets to, say, 6 inches high, 10 inches high, or whatever. We don't go by its height, because that can be deceptive. So it may be that you've just grown it for a little bit too long, that it all starts to keel over a bit.
Right. So each sort of seed will develop a second shoot. Is that what
you're saying? That's right. Yes. Yeah. And as soon as you start to notice that it splits at the base, that's when it's ready to harvest. And if you leave it too long, so what I do at that time is I've actually cut for a lot, juice what we need. And then just store the rest in a box in the fridge, and it will last 5 days once it's cut.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, well, I'll try that. Brilliant, yeah. We're probably coming up to about the hour mark now, so it's gone really quickly. So, yeah, it's.
Time flies when you're having fun.
So, indeed, yeah. So, I thought before we go, perhaps you could tell us a little about the services you're offering and how people can get in touch with you.
Absolutely. Well, I have a website, and of course, haven't ever been these days. I'm always updating my website as to what I'm up to and when. So my website is www.optimizedliving.com. My company is called Optimized Living. And just for the non-Americans in the audience, it's optimized with an S and not with a Z. There is a company in the States called Optimized Living, and that's spelt with optimized with a Z. That's not me. I think they do home improvements or something like that, so that's definitely not me. I'm no carpenter or handyman or anything. And the services I offer are quite varied. I do most of my work is through consulting, and what I do is I take clients on a private basis, and we do an individual consultation, which generally lasts 2 to 2.5 hours. I do a full lifestyle analysis for them, and then make recommendations based on the answers that they've given me to quite a comprehensive set of questions in a questionnaire. And then I write a full written report for them afterwards. I do also offer telephone coaching following a consultation, and so I can do that on an hourly basis for clients. I teach group and individual sprouting classes, and I lecture nationally to audiences that would like a speaker on any aspect of health. I also have some CD recordings that I've made, and MP3 versions are available of some of the talks and lectures that I've done in the past. And I also, once a week, lecture at Health Etc. I understand that you've interviewed Rhianne Torres.
Yes, yeah.
And I work quite closely with Rhianne up at her centre, Health Etc. near Winchester. And I'm usually there on Friday to give a lecture. So guests at the centre come and listen to the lecture, and also people that aren't resident at Health Etc. can come along and pay a small fee and come and hear me speak and ask me questions and have lunch afterwards as well, which is always really nice. So I've got, there are a number of services that I offer which are all outlined on the website, and my clients range from 15-year-olds who just want to improve their overall health, through to former international athletes, and right up to people in their 80s and 90s who are either trying to reverse degenerative disease or want to just improve their overall health and enjoy their old age and retirement. So I'm very happy to help people of all walks of life with regard to health and nutrition. So that's what I do. Pretty much anything's available, really.
All right, great. Okay, well, that's, yeah, it's a very comprehensive service. I'm yeah, sure there's something in there for everyone. So, yeah, I'd like to take this opportunity. Yeah, Max, thank you very much for sparing me the time to have this chat. And yeah,
it's great. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And yeah, hopefully people learn something from this and, you know, hope to start improving their diets. So thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.